the model of everything that is treacherous and tricky in those awful Greeks. Okay, the folks who destroyed Troy, they did it by treachery, and Ulysses showed them how to do it. And in fact, he therefore is seen to be, in many ways, the opposite of Aeneas. Right? In Virgil's poem, Aeneas represents fidelity to duty, the ability to put duty ultimately ahead of individual and personal pleasure. It turns out that Ulysses is conspicuously presented as a person who lacks that sense of loyalty. He's an anti-Aeneas, if you will. And what Dante does is kind of continue this story in Inferno 26. He basically shows Ulysses as somebody who comes back home, 10 years of war, 10 years of wandering after the war, and he gets home. And of course, that's the way the Odyssey ends. And then he says, let's go, men, on a new voyage. Let's go do something else. And in doing that, he seems to be valuing experience for its own sake without regard to any goal, without regard, for example, to the same kind of goal-oriented journey that Aeneas has undertaken. And just as Aeneas learns how to put himself at the service of others, Ulysses learns how to put others to work for him. And so, in a way, that aspect of it comes as close as we might be able to get to defining the meaning of false counsel. And in fact, in the story that Dante tells, leaving the known world behind, he leads his men and himself to death, and his impressive exhortations promise an adventure that he's simply not able to deliver. Very dramatic, very exciting, and ultimately very seductive vision of evil.
I would argue that just as we can see Ulysses as a kind of anti-Aeneas, I think we can also see him as sort of an anti-Augustine. Because one of the things that Ulysses says as he sort of rounds up these sailors to go off and, you know, let's go do some more stuff, let's go take another trip, he says, that I want to know the world and have experience of all man's vices, of all human worth. And he urges his sailors to have all the experiences there are, and he gives them as the reason for wanting to do that, that they're Greeks, that that's what Greeks do. Well, Augustine has a very interesting problem that he develops in his sort of step-by-step journey toward God. One of the big leaps Augustine has to make, part of learning that you're not the center of the world, and that the world doesn't revolve around you, is learning that human knowledge is limited and human experience is limited, and one simply has to trust. Augustine says, in fact, it's really not an issue. Everybody trusts something. The question is, what do you trust? Well, the answer for Ulysses is, I don't trust anything beyond my own experience, beyond the things my senses tell me. And that therefore, while Augustine had to make, I guess what we today call in common parlance, that sort of leap of faith, this is exactly something that consciously Ulysses refuses to do. He refuses to believe or accept as true anything that he's not directly experienced, and therefore he's limited by his own senses. In some ways, one could also argue that in saying, you know, gosh, this is what Greeks do, that Dante's sort of taking a Pauline position, the position of St. Paul, who talks about the fact the Greeks value wisdom and knowledge too much, that it's too all-inclusive for them. They also fail in their faith very often. So I think that this is sort of not only an anti-type of the great pagan hero, it's also an anti-type of a great Christian hero.
When we move from Canto 26 to Canto 27, we stay in the same sin. By the way, I might add that the punishment for the sin, picking up something that Bill said before, is that the sinners are encased in a tongue of fire. And when they speak, their voice is carried out through the tip of the flame, which kind of wiggles a little bit. Okay? And Dante is therefore speaking to these folks, and they're speaking back to him through this sort of flaming barrier. And this is true both of Ulysses' punishment and the punishment of the modern example, who turns out to be somebody named Guido da Montefeltro. Guido, it turns out, has an interesting career, if not quite as interesting as Ulysses. It's interesting nonetheless. He was somebody who was apparently known for his ability as a strategist and a kind of hired gun strategist. Okay, somebody, if you had a particularly tricky military problem, call on Guido and he'd tell you what to do. right? That he would undoubtedly today belong to a think tank where they sort of planned long-range military strategy, but he would be somebody who would